TFM.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Star Trek Enterprise podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, a little advice as we start to record? Stay close to the door. Otherwise, your impressive collection of Star Trek, Star Wars, and Superman memorabilia could suddenly fly across the room. We don't want you in the path of that.
Well, Chris, I have been worried about all of these facial anomalies in my office. I don't know what's causing it, but I do know having to come in every day and pick up has not been fun. It's either that or it's Toy Story in my room, and they're not putting themselves back where they go. So I'm not sure which one's more plausible.
Well, everyone, we are going to be continuing our 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise today with the first episode of Season 3. We're shifting gears with the Zindi. And here's a quick rundown of the story. As Enterprise journeys deeper into the Delphic expanse, a tip from a freighter captain leads to an inhospitable planet where a lone Zindi may hold the key Archer needs. But finding help in this region of space is not so easy, especially if you don't keep liquid platinum on hand, and Trip and Archer find themselves in a Trillium D pickle. Thank goodness the NX-01 is now carrying a brigade of soldiers ready to extract the group of would-be explorers from whatever danger they happen into. But after a harrowing adventure, Archer finds that he's no closer to locating the Zindi homeworld. All the crew has to show for their efforts are a debris field and a massage. So, Matthew, I know you want to talk about the massage, but we'll get to that later. Let's just start with the most obvious thing that we see at the start of this episode, the Zindi themselves, the concept of the Zindi. For once, Star Trek does something at this stage in its life as a franchise that's really different than they've done before. We've got five distinct extant species of Zindi, in this case, on one planet. Sharing the planet. What did you think about that concept?
You know, I think as a concept, you know, and again, look, it's science fiction, so you can do whatever it is that you want. And I think that's the beauty of that. I think that it makes for an interesting dynamic then. It's quite fascinating to me because even while doing the five distinct species, they still pull off the monospecies though, because all aquatics are the same. All arboreals seem to be the same. The primates seem to be, you know, so I find that to be kind of interesting that they still kind of fall into the same Star Trek trap, even though we're doing something that's a bit different. I do think it's interesting as well, though, because just as a science fiction type of idea, like a science idea, and Star Trek has always tried to stay quite close or as close as it can to science to make it feel as real as possible. I mean, this is probably the most ludicrous idea that they've ever come up with, because the odds of this happening are so astronomical. I mean, the odds of evolution happening on one planet in the first place are astronomical in the same universe. The odds of this happening in the same universe as we are, you know, where... most species tend to be primate-based, at least according to Star Trek. It's just, I mean, it makes zero sense. But I don't really care, because I think at least they are trying to do something different. And I think this is an episode which does go to show that this show is taking a giant leap forward in what it's trying to do. And I think the whole episode, in many ways, is rife with and littered with all of the ways in which this show is kind of taking a right turn. You know, like we were going one way and then we're going to go right. And this is one of the big places where they do that, where they create this species that kind of throws everything for a loop that we've seen in Star Trek, that at the same time plays by all the same Star Trek rules. So that's very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about how within the different species of Zindi, they have that monoculture. I hadn't thought about that too much, because when I look at the Zindi, I'm more focused on the fact that they're showing that on this one planet, there are these different groups. And when you look at the planet as a whole, if you look at the group that we would just call Zindi, you've got this diversity that we haven't seen very often in Star Trek. Certainly not up to this point. You know, the newer series have done a better job of trying to add some diversity to familiar races, like the Klingons, for example. But at this point, it was pretty fresh. But you're right, that within each group, they're all together, they're very much focused, which I guess they have to be for this story, because the story would get really messy if you had diverse thinking within the aquatics, within the arboreals, and so forth.
Right.
And then among the Zindi as well.
Right.
As a science fiction concept, I do enjoy it, though. And like you said, the odds of this happening are astronomical. But given the size of the universe and the number of planets and the number of chances, it's possible that this could happen once, but it's not something that you're likely to happen across. And beyond that, the idea that all five are at essentially the same technological level with one another, that's like another step beyond what would be plausible. But it doesn't matter really, because it works well for this story. And the other thing I like about it for the story is that it complicates Archer's mission. Because it's one thing to say, hey, we were attacked by the Zindi. Earth has to go find these aliens called the Zindi, and we have to deal with them. But when you send someone like Archer, who has started out as an explorer, and even though we see him changing a lot in this episode, you can tell at other times in this story that he still, you know, his inner nature is still to be kind to people and to be diplomatic and to try to build good relationships with people. And when you throw him this curveball of, hey, it's not one group of aliens that we're dealing with here. We're going to be dealing with five groups, and they don't even agree with each other. And then you have to somehow deal with them to save your homeworld. Your mission becomes far more complex. So I think that they, from the very beginning, they've set up this story to give themselves a lot to work with as writers.
Well, and the other thing about this is, and I find this to be a conundrum then for Archer and the crew, which is when you find out that there are five distinct species, well, you can't then just assume that they're all together in the same area, you know, and maybe some Zindi are a part of this, some Zindi aren't. I mean, and I think really what it does is it creates a amount of complexity, you know, as we're starting off on this mission, to just show that this is not going to be a quick fix. You know, I think the episode does that as well, in the sense that, you know, they've been in the expanse for 6 weeks and they've really found nothing so far. They're already running into spatial distortions, which are causing havoc on the ship. And then you throw in this whole thing about there being more than one Zindi species. It really does, I think, let you know that there's a lot going on here. And I think it also, what's so interesting to me is rewatching this episode. This episode actually sets up the entire arc in here, which is that they are going to find Zindi who will help them. And it was really fascinating. Of course, you know, we have this Zindi where, you know, Archer has rescued him. He's brought him back regardless of, you know, what he had done. And his humanity wins out. And that humanity is what gives them the opportunity to, they found a debris field, but they also had a Zindi actually help them. And so I find it very interesting, looking in retrospective, as we are, 20th anniversary, this really sets up exactly where this whole story is going to go in the very first episode, which you know, kind of creates a good sense of writing, because if you're paying attention, even in this very first episode of this season, you're getting a picture of how it's going to end and what it's going to take to actually conquer the problem that we've set up with the Zindi, and the fact that maybe it's not really the Zindi that are the problem. And so I just found that really kind of fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. So another thing that's immediately noticeable is that the music is upbeat now, because we reached season three and the studio is feeling like, well, you know, we need to energize the show. That's part of the reason for the turn here in the more exciting Search for the Zindi storyline.
I see what you did there. Energize the show.
Mm-hmm. Energize the show. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, we get Star Trek Enterprise on the screen as the title. This is the moment where they decided that maybe people would be confused about what the show was if it didn't have Star Trek in the name on the screen. Now, we've talked about that many times on Warp 5 and elsewhere on the network. What I did notice this time, which I didn't think about in past viewings really, is that when Archer reads the dialogue at the very beginning, the recap of the previous season, he says previously on Enterprise. He doesn't say previously on Star Trek Enterprise. So obviously when this was written and shot and all the voiceover was done and everything, at that point, the show was still called Enterprise. And sometime before it aired, they decided they needed to stick the Star Trek on top of the name. So I just noticed that as I was watching this time as well. But I mean, how do you feel about the music? You know, in Deep Space Nine, you and I do the Orb together. We're big Niners. Mm-hmm. And I think we both like the shift in the music that happened on Deep Space Nine. I know I do, because I feel like it reflects the change of in the show and the level of action and intensity and intrigue and all that's happening on that show starting from season four onward. Mm-hmm. Here, do you feel the same way? And do you feel like the style of the upbeat nature fits the story that we're getting here in season three?
I have to say that I absolutely hate what they do with the theme, mainly because I think the theme, and I've probably said this many times on the network, I love the theme for Enterprise, and I think it fit perfectly with what they wanted and where they were trying to go, and just the show in general. I mean, it just really made sense to, I think, do this and use it the way they had. And the problem is that by adding this backbeat to this song, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The song is not meant for that. It's meant to be more of a ballad, you know? And by doing this, I think it actually just, it really hurts what they had. I think that makes the song even more cheesy than it was before. That's the problem. Yeah. You know, if you were worried about the show and its cheesiness, well, what you've done is you've just made it 20 times worse, I think. And so I find it to be really dumb that they made this decision. And I do really think that it just hurts the series. And that's frustrating, because you didn't need to do this. So,
yeah, I think the difference here between what they did with Enterprise and what they did with Deep Space Nine for me is that with Enterprise, there are a couple of problems. One is that the key and just the tone of the music in its upbeat version is too bright. It doesn't fit the story. Yeah. Whereas the Deep Space Nine one fits perfectly. And actually, one thing I love about the Deep Space Nine one is they put that bass line under there that doesn't quite mesh with the melody. It feels like it's fighting the melody all the time. And I think that reflects the nature of the show very well. Here, they're on this mission to find people who killed 7 million people on Earth. And you've got this kind of bright, upbeat theme to it, which it just feels odd.
Right.
And I love the theme for the show, and I think it works wonderfully in the first two seasons. I think it reflects what the show is about, this like finding your way to the stars and journeying into the unknown. And the pace of it reflects the fact that you don't know what you're going to get into. You're a little bit cautious as you explore. And I think that in this situation, even though there's this sense of urgency to find the Zindi, there's also a caution, even though Archer tells Malcolm in this episode that we can't just be cautious all the time. We don't have time to do it. But there is, right? Because they don't know what they're getting into. And I think that if they were going to make it upbeat, it should have been done in a more serious tone, a more like a feeling of risk to it, and instead of a feeling of fun, which is what they ended up doing. And ultimately, it seems like they did it just because someone on the studio executive staff thought that, you know, we got to pep things up a little bit. We got to energize the show, as I said before, without actually having a good reason behind it. So, yeah, I'm not not a fan of the upbeat music.
Well, and like you said, and especially just, look, season three is a shift in tone, and it's darker. And so, therefore, doing this seems so incongruous with where you're taking the show.
Yeah, exactly.
The actual show.
Right.
And it just doesn't make sense. Yeah. And so.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that dark turn, apart from the music becoming upbeat, the series, it really does become much darker right off the bat than what we got in seasons one and two, where we're really exploring, we're meeting new aliens, we're seeing technology rolled out for the first time. The early scene with Archer talking to Malcolm, which I just mentioned, you know, Archer, he's very frustrated. He dresses Malcolm down for wanting to play it safe. When they're in the mining facility, Trip is ready to kick ass when he doesn't get the information he wants from the Zindi. And you've got people having their fingers cut off. They're being put into forced labor to mine Trillium D. The whole environment that we see in this episode is dirty and dangerous. And it's just a very different tone Brandon Braga said that they viewed this episode as sort of a new pilot, kind of resetting the series. And of course, it feels that way, but they are looking at it almost like Broken Bow again. It's like, we've got to set up the series again. And they did it in a, like, by turning the whole thing on its head and making it dark.
Well, and I think the thing that makes this kind of interesting is that as I'm rewatching this episode, what I'm realizing is that the turn of darkness is obviously for the crew and their mission. But I think this region of space, and as we're going to see, it because it's so volatile, everybody is scrimping and, you know, trying to get by and doing what they can and taking advantage of other people. And, you know, it's one of those, it's like the hierarchy of needs. And since so many needs here are not being met in the expanse and are in danger, it creates a group of people then that live in the expanse to always be on edge, you know? Yeah. And I think they then lack the place to where they've developed kindness, because this truly is, you know, Darwin's survival of the fittest. What happens when you have to survive, and who's going to survive? Is it just going to be the strongest, you know? And so I really do think that's kind of what this expanse turns into. And it's also the very thing that it threatens to turn our crew into, right? Which is to abandon their ideals for the idea that it's only about who survives, and who survives is about who has the right amount of power, which is so fascinating. We're playing with all these ideas in a world that has, in a universe that has no reason to play nice, right? You know, I mean, there's no higher standards that they have to hold up to other than the ones they impose on themselves. And so it's a fascinating discussion that we end up having here with these characters, but the Expanse itself, I really think, is what allows them to play darker, because it's not just the mission, but it's also this area of space which has created, you know, these races of beings who are living in this expanse where, as we'll learn later, this area of space wasn't always like this, right? You know, it's slowly gotten worse and worse and worse, which in some ways then sees how people there have gotten worse and worse and worse. And so, yeah, I kind of love that whole idea, especially as I rewatch the season, and you kind of see all the ideas that they're playing with in the writer's room. And it also, again, it kind of gives you an opportunity to play in this little pocket universe without really touching the rest of the Star Trek universe that we know. Yeah. Right? And so, yeah, that I never thought of it that way until now. Like, oh, they're in a pocket universe.
Yeah. Pocket universe. Sounds like a good game name or a product name. Or, and also, you said it wasn't always this way, but it gets worse and worse. It sounded like you were describing the airline industry for a moment there.
Very true. I mean, yes.
Also, so, not the safest, and you're not quite sure where things are going to end up, right?
I mean, Superman tells us, though, it's still the safest way to travel. So, statistically speaking.
Yeah. But what you say, it's a good way of pointing out that when Star Trek can branch out a little bit from the familiar, they can do a lot of interesting things with the storytelling without taking us out of the Star Trek universe, but by creating this Delphic expanse and having new aliens and new situations and anomalies. You know, I mean, Harry Kim would be really happy, all these anomalies he can scan for.
Oh, yeah.
But having these anomalies and having substances like Trillium D that we haven't heard of before, but are all still plausible within the framework of the Star Trek universe as we know it, opens up all kinds of storytelling that was closed off before. And again, allows you to put the characters in situations that force them to grow, change, adapt, reflect on themselves, which is another thing that I do like about this turn in Enterprise. Not that we weren't getting it before, because I think we were getting good character development in Enterprise up to this point. But comparing Star Trek series to Deep Space Nine and what they did with character development, what they do here with The Expanse, it allows the writers to delve even more deeply into how the situation impacts individuals, like the way the Dominion War impacts individuals on Deep Space Nine.
Right.
And it opens up the show a lot in that way.
Well, and I think we've spent 2 years, right, of these characters. They've been out in space. They've been exploring. They have these ideals of what that's going to be like and what it's going to look like. Right. And they've slowly been realizing that it's going to be different than they thought. And this event kind of slaps them all in the face to wake them up to say, yes, it's going to be very different than you thought. Right. And so really, in many ways, Enterprise in this season is doing exactly what Deep Space Nine did in its seasons, which is to challenge the preconceptions of the ideas of the Federation and what would be the Federation, right? And so this, you know, we've talked a lot about on how Enterprise is all about, especially in the Vulcan side, about them overcoming who they were at that point and growing and becoming better than they were. And I think this is also the same place that we have our human characters, and really it's about, can we overcome the basest parts of our nature to rise above even when challenged, and not just, you know, return to our instinctual natures. And that's the questions that are being asked, you know, especially when we're put to the challenge, you know, and there's a big challenge here, in much the same way the Dominion War challenged all of the Federation and the Alpha and Beta quadrants. You know, this, where it's on a much smaller scale because it's just humanity and, you know, T'Pol that are being challenged.
And
so
Phlox.
Well, yes, true. But what we're doing here is we're also forging the humanity. We're putting humanity through the crucible that's mm-hmm. going to allow them to either create the Federation mm-hmm. or to create something completely different.
Right.
And so that we're putting them on that knife's edge, and this whole season is about that, and of course season four is about that as well. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, it's a really interesting challenge because other than Deep Space Nine, you've never really tried this before in Star mm-hmm. Trek, and yeah. At least at this point.
At this point, and also it's interesting that in Deep Space Nine with the Dominion War and Section 31 and so forth, we're dealing with trying to protect the Federation, protect the ideals that are very well established at that point. But here, like you say, we're dealing with pre-Federation. So we're dealing with a situation that could lead to the Federation either never being founded or being founded under very different ideals than what we're accustomed to. And would change the entire course of humanity and the galaxy, mm-hmm. at least yeah. the yep. Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant, anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of changing in that way, fans love to debate for many years whether Starfleet is a military organization or a scientific exploratory organization. And I maintain that it's a bit of both by necessity. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But in seasons one and two of Enterprise, it really is primarily a scientific exploratory organization. But here, the Mako, the Military Assault Command Operation, comes aboard. We get soldiers posted to Enterprise. It was mentioned in the finale of season two, and now they're here. Mm-hmm. And it really militarizes Starfleet, at least for the time being. So what do you think about that in terms of what it allows the writers to do, but also mm-hmm. how it plays into Starfleet as we come to know it, and perhaps as an in-universe explanation for why Starfleet shifts in that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that really is the whole key to me. The Makos, in many ways, I think, go to prove that Starfleet needs to be a bit of both, right? Mm-hmm. That the military aspect and training that comes along with being out there is a must, while at the same time having the goal of being scientific exploration with the hope of not needing your military training, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that to me is the thing that really makes this work, because it does give a great explanation as to why Starfleet becomes what it becomes as we move further down the line, especially into Kirk's time and then into the Next Generation. And where, you know, you in some ways, then, you know, you're watching the original series and Kirk's like, I'm a soldier, not a diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that you can see how much things have changed by that point, right? And, you know, Kirk sees it more as his role is to keep the peace while exploring, while Archer saw himself mainly as an explorer up until this point. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I like the Makos. I think it's a really interesting idea. You know, of course, Earth being united has a United Earth military, mm-hmm. So that makes sense. And when you're going on this type of mission, I think it also makes sense to have this group, because as is made the point by Major Hayes, which I think is an excellent point, which is, you guys know this ship. We don't. We're here to fight battles so that you guys can stay alive and keep us getting home, because mm-hmm. we don't know how to run this ship. That's not our job, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that creates, really, in many ways, what they're being treated like, and even the way Major Hayes treats himself. I'm mm-hmm. cannon fodder, so we can get this job done and we can go home,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that's an incredibly interesting attitude. I mean, it's quite the attitude for a soldier. That's what most soldiers' attitudes are. Like, I'm here to make sure that everybody else is safe. And so I think it really works. And then, of course, it creates great dynamics then mm-hmm. on the show for us to have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, speaking of those dynamics, so Hayes and Reed, they bump heads in this episode, particularly, like, I think the way you describe Major Hayes, that's accurate to Major Hayes and why he's there, and he understands why he's there. And it seems that Malcolm feels threatened by having these other security or military personnel on the ship when he's supposed to be the head of all of this. Mm-hmm. And at first, you know, there's this friction between the two of them. And near the end of the episode, after everyone's safely back on the ship, he does admit to Tripp that, because Tripp says, I'm sure you and your guys could have done just as well. And Malcolm says that he's not sure about that. So I think, you know, this isn't the end of the friction between the two of them,
right?
Reed and Hayes. But I think that Reed already here is recognizing the value of having them on the ship. And it's just one of those things where you got to figure out, you know, what's the hierarchy here?
Mm-hmm.
And are you comfortable with it? And what's interesting, right. I think, is that it's our main character in Reed who really struggles with adjusting to the new arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As opposed to the new guy coming in and wanting to take over, which he doesn't,
right.
I think, doesn't really seem to have that attitude.
I think it only makes sense when you realize and you remember the storyline, which is Reed comes from a military family, mm-hmm. and he chose not to go into the military. And he, I think, has spent most of his life with a chip on his shoulder that people think he's not capable because he did not go into the British Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore he's taking that out on, and improperly, on Major Hayes. You know, he's putting his own baggage on this character who he doesn't know, and just assuming that he, that Major Hayes has the same, you know, thoughts towards him mm-hmm. that, you know, he's had his family give him. And mm-hmm. that's completely incorrect, of course. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there is that psychological problem that Malcolm has right now, which is basically, you know, he's projecting. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, it's inappropriate, one, for his position. And two, yes, like you said, it's going to cause continued problems because mm-hmm. Malcolm won't be able to let it go. And it's interesting because, in all honesty, Hayes here is just trying to do his job, mm-hmm. you know? And it's no wonder it comes to what it comes to later on because, yeah, you know, this dude just won't let you do your job
mm-hmm.
And keeps giving you attitude all the time. Like, you know, after a while, you do have to kind of find a way to confront it. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's what it'll come to. So, I think this is great that we end up with this kind of friction because they'd already written the reason for why Malcolm would have this friction earlier in seasons 1 and 2.
Yeah, that's a key thing, right? It doesn't come out of the blue. It's already been established. It's been set up.
Mm-hmm.
Even if when they set it up, they had no idea they would ever have Mako on the show.
Oh, exactly.
But at least it's there. And mm-hmm. they can build on it in a natural way, so it's not one of those mm-hmm. like convoluted reasons to create conflict within the show. And I, you know, all the Mako who we see in this episode, they all seem very personable. They're all very nice and polite to the Enterprise crew, and they're there to protect them. And not trying to create any kind of friction with the crew.
Right. Well, and I mean, you know, you see Hoshi trying to get to know them and those type of things to welcome them aboard. And that's going to be something that will continue throughout the season, is seeing these relationships build across, you know, from Starfleet to the Makos. And I think what it also helps them be able to do is, you know, have these new characters on the show that allow for those type of relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a lot of fun, you know? I mean, because you're putting a whole unexplored element mm-hmm. into the show.
Yeah. Well, speaking of friction, of course, we have to talk about sexy time with Trip and T'Pol. So matchmaker Phlox seems to think that some neuropressure might help the overall situation here Trip Tucker. And T'Pol is more ready to help than I guess I would have expected her to be. And there's one thing I picked up on here as well, which I didn't notice before, that could be like the start of the storyline for T'Pol, but I'll mention that in a minute. But what did you think about this element? Like, does it make sense for the story, or do you feel like it's an extension of the decon chamber that goes all the way back to Broken Bow, where they're trying to push the boundaries of television at the time, trying to spice things up, you know, show some skin on the screen, to put it bluntly, in the hopes of pulling in more viewers because, oh, this is, you know, it's not the Star Trek I'm used to. It's a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that's part of it. Right. But I think the most interesting thing is that, one, this does allow us to be able to explore Vulcan society in an interesting way. Right. I think, you know, I doubt that Vulcans would be so kind of prudish. It seems like they're very private about their sexuality and the way it works between them as a species. But the idea of, you know, being logical about the needs of the body and, you know, the idea of giving them kind of almost this Eastern sense of medicine, you know, that they would have this, that all makes complete sense because it's very much, I think, in line with Vulcan philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. It's very logical.
Yeah.
And so I think all of that really makes sense. You know, I also think it makes sense in the sense of just the character of, like, of Trip, who's gone through this trauma and is having trouble sleeping, and the idea of the doctor, you know, look, he can keep putting him to sleep, but this medication is not something that he should be on for a long period of time, right? It's akin to the discussion of painkillers, right? And that, yes, they can be good, but they can also become very addictive and harmful. And so that trying to keep your patient safe from that type of thing. And in all honesty, I think the most interesting part of this is that what this is going to allow to have happen is to have two characters who don't realize that they need somebody to be there for them, to therefore then be there for them. And what's interesting is Trip and T'Pol already kind of have a closer relationship because of the fact that he's intercepted that letter. He knows some very personal things about her. They've begun to grow closer. And this just allows them to continue to do that. I think the biggest problem becomes is that, you know, Enterprise, and this is the beginning of it for these two characters, but Enterprise was afraid to do the thing that was so successful in Deep Space Nine, which is if two characters should be together, put them together and don't do this whole song and dance for seasons, you know? And I think they just didn't know, or they just didn't trust that if they put these two characters together, it's not a moonlighting situation, right?
Yeah, right.
Which, you know, but Deep Space Nine, again, had already proven that you can put characters in your show together and people will love it. Right. I mean, people still talks about the talk about the Dax and the Worf relationship or, you know, Ezri and Bashir.
Yeah.
You know, and so
I do feel like putting two characters together on that station, the dynamic is a bit different than putting two characters together on such a small ship like the NX-01, where both of the characters are part of the senior staff as well. So I can understand some hesitation there, but I think that, yeah, like you say, this scene reads very differently once you know what it leads to with the characters in the in the long term, and then it makes a lot more sense. Based on just the scene here, if you watched it one time, as a journalist, as a writer, if I were writing a headline for this, at one point I thought my headline would be "Florida Man Misses Hints," because it seemed like he was missing the mm-hmm. what T'Pol was trying to tell him at the beginning of the of the exchange here in her quarters. But yeah, I think that. They're taking chances with the writing, and they're doing something that, like you said, they were afraid to do earlier. And not to jump too far ahead here in the rewatch, but it ultimately leads to some really good character development, and so it does make sense to have it in here.
Yeah, and I agree.
Yeah. So one more quick thing I just wanted to ask your thoughts on. Well, it's not only at the end, but I'm thinking of the final scene where we see the Zindian sectoid saying that, hey, if you guys don't go take care of them, I'll go destroy their ship myself, or, you know, have my guys do it. The visuals at that point of the insectoid, when we look at it now, it seems pretty basic, might even seem a little bit primitive in terms of a CGI character. But at the time, I remember watching it, it was pretty groundbreaking to have that kind of...
Yeah.
CGI character on a television show, on a TV budget at that time. How do you think it reads now when you watch it with the HD? I guess it's not remastered because it was shot in HD in the first place, but when you watch it on Blu-rays, you know, how do you think it reads now?
You know, it's interesting because for the most part, the show still looks pretty good. My wife and I have a brand new OLED, and the show does well for the most part. You know, I think, you know, we were at the time still where, you know, we're not rendering things in higher quality than is needed, you know? And yeah, this is still at this point, we're pushing the boundaries of what's available and what's best to use on television. And they're definitely trying. And so I don't get upset about that. You know, I mean, there's a big difference in being a pioneer and then doing something now. You know, I think when you see, when I see what you did in, say, episode one, right, you're literally pioneering again new technologies that if you don't make the push, you're not going to get into the mainstream. And Lucas was always willing to do that from the first Star Wars series, the second Star Wars series, and everything in between, right? And so I don't get upset about people trying to push those boundaries and push mediums in new directions. And Enterprise is trying to do that. I have no problems with it. And I just don't, you know, is it great? No. Do I care? No. I think it's a little bit different than, you know, when Babylon 5 tried to do CGI.
Yeah.
You just were not ready.
Yeah. Well, they were 10 years earlier than this trying to do that. And the computers and back so then were not capable of rendering stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's a place where you were trying to push the boundaries too quickly. And so, but, you know, with Enterprise, I don't really have a problem with it. And I think this show still holds up and looks pretty stinking good for the most part. And in this season, too, they've made things slightly moodier with the lighting, and they're and I think it actually works for the show. And but you know, you can also still see things on the bridge, so it's, you know, it's not one of those situations that people complain about, say, with Star Trek Picard,
where you can't see what's going on, right? No, I think the insectoids look quite good. You know, obviously they would look more realistic today if they were to create this today, but on a TV budget back then, I think it was great and it still looks good today. So what are your final thoughts, Matthew, for the Zindi, the episode that is, and your rating?
It's a great start, I think, to the season, honestly. I think that what it sets up is that this is going to be an incredibly tough mission for this crew, and we are going to put them through the ringer. And how they come out of it is going to be very interesting. And we're pushing everybody's buttons, and we're going to push everyone to the edge, and maybe a little bit beyond. And I think that that's a really great place to, you know, after 2 years with these characters now, is to see what they're made of. And I can't wait to continue as we do that with season three. And I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 pinchers, because, you know, those insectoid pinchers, you got to watch out for them. Pinchers. So, yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah, I think it's a great start to the story as well. And especially when you go into a setup like this and you know that you've got 24 episodes in this story, as opposed to today when you go into a setup and you know you've got 10 episodes.
Right.
Just imagining where they're going to go with this and how involved the story is going to become when they have that much time to work with is exciting. And I've come to enjoy it a lot more over the years than I did when it first came on. I think, as we'll probably discuss over the next few months, I think the story of season three works best when you watch it quickly, and rather than one episode every week waiting for things to unfold. But it's a really good start to it. So I'm going to give this episode 7 Duluth inflections.
Fantastic.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on the Zindi. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're already a member, you know how it works. If you're joining for the first time, though, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your comments with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose Warp 5, and that will make its way through the Delphic Expanse to Matthew and me by email. And you can also find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not getting rubdowns from T'Pol, where can people find you?
Oh my goodness. You can find me all over the place under social media. Name's Matt Rushing02. You can also find me here on the network outside of the Star Trek Talk and the 602 Club, as we're talking about all of those fandoms and franchises we love. So check that out as well. And of course, we've got The Orb, The Artificial Tango, Saddle Up, and you'll find me sometimes on Literary Treks as well. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network with 2 shows. One's completed, called Owl Post, about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And I do aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we're talking about Star Wars. But, you know, Chris, when you're not trying to figure out exactly what those inflections are of the insectoid and kind of pinpoint where they're from, where can people find you?
Yeah, those insectoids, they're from Zindi Duluth. It's a little bit different than Minnesota, but I know Hoshi can still pinpoint the street they grew up on. And you can find me here on the network, as you mentioned, all those shows that you and I do together. Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time. You can find me in all sorts of episodes in the back catalog. You can also find me on social media. I'd love to chat with you wherever you are. Twitter's where I'm most active, but you can find me on all the platforms. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch, everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to help us to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your help. So thank you so much to everyone who's supporting us right now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to going deeper into the expanse with you next time here on Warp 5.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to see where that takes us. So let's go.